even a few months ago, all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic. We are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy, where proper tax system is not in place, and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward, what to react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination programme is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. Based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel, as an occupying power, to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintained that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130.
But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
Faced with the dilemma of holding or postponing an election in the midst of a pandemic, politicians in Catalonia have chosen to heed health experts' advice to adjourn a February election as a surge in coronavirus cases threatened to overwhelm hospitals in what local media perceive as the third wave of the pandemic.
In the coming weeks, everyone needs to focus exclusively on the evolution of the pandemic and on the need to avoid the collapse of the healthcare system.
The pro-independence government picked May 30th as the chosen date for the next poll.
It's simply because that's when health experts believe the pandemic will subside and conditions will get better. It's the end of the cold season, the contagion will be reduced, and most of all, we are likely to have vaccinated a large part of the population by then.
All parties agreed to postpone the election, but the Socialist Party of Catalonia, the offshoot of Spain's Socialist Party leading the central government in Madrid, said the date was too far away.
What we object is that some have taken advantage of the legitimate fears about the COVID-19 to advance a different agenda. We believe that some parties seem to have taken into account what the polls say more than what the health data say.
Latest opinion polls show the separatists leading a majority in the 135-seat regional parliament, possibly passing the 50% symbolic threshold for the first time. But growing divisions between the two largest pro-independence blocs, led by Oriol Junqueras from jail and Carles Puigdemont from exile, suggest they may seek new alliances to form a new government.
With the vote on hold, the focus in Catalonia now is on the evolution of the contagion in the coming weeks and the progress of vaccination. There's a shared feeling that the more people get the vaccine, the safer the environment for in-person voting. Cosay Kadri, Barcelona.
Health systems in the EU are buckling under pressure from new coronavirus cases resulting from the holiday period. New variants are raising concern. Businesses remain closed. These have been identified as major challenges for the Portuguese government, which has just taken over the rotating presidency of the EU.
One of the first priorities is vaccination. Vaccination is the light at the end of the tunnel of this pandemic.
Critics say vaccination should currently be the only priority for EU authorities. The UK is approving jabs weeks ahead of the 27-country bloc. Secrecy surrounds the number of vaccines going to each EU nation and how many people have so far received the jab. The European Commission says it is working with the European Centre for Disease Control to set up an information website. And that cannot happen soon enough because a major criticism of the vaccination programme in the EU relates to a lack of data. It is simply impossible to scrutinise or compare the performances of member states. We have been talking to EU citizens in Brussels about the speed of the vaccine's rollout.
My father is 76. I don't know where it will be for him. It will be me. Maybe in 4 or 5 months. That's quite slow.
It's not easy. Yeah. It's too slow. I think the priorities are not the best one.
Trying to understand why it's so slow in EU. I don't know. Maybe we need more testing to be sure of the vaccine.
Me, I really want to live
like a normal person, like you, we like the way we did. So if I have to be vaccinated, I will be vaccinated.
Cracks continue to appear within the EU's unity as countries move to secure vaccines independently of the European Commission. Adding to the woes is news that production of the Pfizer vaccine is being temporarily delayed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of people, including leaders and supporters of the far right, take to the streets of Vienna to protest against COVID restrictions.
This isn't the first protest of its kind here in Austria, and it comes as the country is in its third lockdown. That lockdown is expected to end on the 24th of January.
With hardly any masks in sight and no distance between them, demonstrators only booed and whistled when asked by the police to observe the safety rules. Many of the banners, signs and slogans repeated claims that the pandemic was part of a conspiracy in which the World Health Organization and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates were complicit.
Are you not worried about contracting the virus?
I'm not worried about the virus because it's not dangerous for 99.9% of the population. It's not dangerous. It's just dangerous for very old, very sick people. And yes, for these people, influenza too is dangerous. And COVID-19 is not more dangerous than influenza.
These claims have been strongly refuted by experts who cite evidence-based data to prove that COVID is far more deadly and significantly more contagious than seasonal flu. In fact, with the emergence of new variants, experts believe we're now in the most dangerous time of the pandemic. Demonstrators also shouted slogans against the government's vaccination program that's already well underway.
The people should decide for ourselves, and not because the law is decided for us. We want to decide, is this our body, is this our brain, our life, and not the life of the government.
With the rate of new infections still considered way too high, the government is expected to announce a further tightening of restrictions. Homolevsky, Vienna.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend. The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down. Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people, and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. And so you're looking at something where at the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Italy topped 1 million COVID jabs since the start of the vaccination campaign on December 31st, according to the latest data, out of over 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine delivered across the country since December 27, more than 60% have already been injected, the highest number of first doses administered in the EU. However, some Italian media have been warning in recent days about an increasing number of medics and health workers not willing to be vaccinated.
Vaccination rates among health workers is quite high, however, about 10% of medical staff remain very skeptical. The lack of testing is one of people's main concerns. We are observing the effects of the vaccine while it's being administered.
A poll released in mid-December caused surprise in Italy by showing that one-third of the population were not willing to be vaccinated, along with half of nurses and other health workers.
I have my reservations over the vaccine because the matter has not been discussed much yet. I would have injected only if it becomes obligatory.
New polls are showing the scenario seems to have changed in recent days, with more Italians willing to receive the coronavirus vaccine. Medics promoting anti-vaccination propaganda have been warned or disciplined by doctors' associations.
Doctors' guilds in Italy have been conducting inquiries into medics accused of unwarranted criticism of vaccinations. Tens of medics have been punished with measures ranging from warnings to two-month suspensions.
Doctors' guilds' actions being timely and appropriate. Unfortunately, some medics should be trained on how to express their views on social platforms as they aren't aware of the consequences of their inflammatory posts.
Meanwhile, a joint report by the Health Ministry and the Higher Health Institute is warning the COVID-19 epidemic in Italy risks becoming uncontrolled as the virus RT reproduction number has been increasing for 5 weeks straight. The country's COVID-19 death toll has risen to over 81,000. Max Civili, Rome.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The spectre of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought and conflict contributed to the famine, which swept through Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of the defiant regional government. Leaders of Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost three decades, but were sidelined after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. The article you're about to hear has been written by Kara Anna. The piece is titled Extreme Urgent Need, Starvation Haunts Ethiopia's Tigray. The article has been taken from the Chronicle.com website. Please stay with us for more of Kara Anna's article. From emaciated refugees to crops burned on the brink of harvest, starvation threatens the survivors of more than 2 months of fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The first humanitarian workers to arrive after pleading with the Ethiopian government for access describe weakened children dying from diarrhea after drinking from rivers. Shops were looted or depleted weeks ago. A local official told a 1st of January crisis meeting of government and aid workers that hungry people had asked for a single biscuit. Participants say more than 4.5 million people, nearly the region's entire population, need emergency food. According to minutes obtained by the Associated Press, at their next meeting on 8th of January, a Tigray administrator warned that without aid and food, hundreds of thousands might starve to death. And some had already starved. Marie Carmen Vinoles, head of the emergency unit for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, told the Associated Press, "There is an extreme urgent need. I don't know what more words in English to use to rapidly scale up the humanitarian response because the population is literally dying every day. They are dying as we speak." But pockets of fighting, resistance from some officials, and sheer destruction stand in the way of a massive food delivery effort. The meeting's minutes said to send 15 kilograms of rations to 4.5 million people would require more than 2,000 trucks, while some local responders are reduced to getting around on foot. The spectre of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought, conflict, and government denial contributed to the famine, which swept through the Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of defiant regional government. Leaders of the Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost three decades, but were sidelined largely after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict. More than 550,000 have fled into neighboring Sudan, where one doctor has said new arrivals show signs of starvation. Others shelter in rugged terrain. A woman who recently left Tigray region described sleeping in caves with people who brought cattle, goats, and the grain they had managed to harvest. A letter by the Catholic Bishop of Adigrat said recently, "It is a daily reality to hear people dying with the fighting consequences and because of lack of food." Hospitals and other health centers crucial in treating malnutrition have been destroyed. The United Nations says in markets, food is not available or extremely scarce and limited. Though Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed declared victory in late November, its military and allied fighters remain active amid the presence of troops from neighboring Eritrea, a bitter enemy of the now fugitive officials who once led the Tigray region. Fear keeps many people from venturing out. Others have fled. Tigray's new officials say more than 2 million people have been displaced. The United Nations says the number of people reached with aid is extremely low. A senior Ethiopian government official, Radwan Hussein, did not respond to a request for comment on Tigray colleagues' warning of starvation. A United Nations source said in the northern Shire area near Eritrea, which has seen some of the worst fighting, up to 10% of the children whose arms were measured met the diagnostic criteria for severe acute malnutrition, with scores of children affected. The source, speaking on condition of anonymity, sharing the concern of many humanitarian workers and aid workers about jeopardizing access to Ethiopia. Near Shire town are camps housing nearly 100,000 refugees who have fled over the years from Eritrea. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said recently, "Some who have walked into town are emaciated, begging for aid and begging for food that is not available." Food has been a target. Analyzing satellite imagery of the Shire area, a United Kingdom-based research group found two warehouse-style structures in the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, compound at one refugee camp had been very specifically destroyed. The DX Open Network could not tell by whom or who has done the destruction. It reported a new attack recently. It's challenging to verify events in Tigray region as communication links remain poor and almost no journalists are allowed to visit the region. Meanwhile, an official with Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, Vinoles, has said that in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum, the level of civilian casualties is extremely high in the places we have been able to access. She cited the fighting and lack of health care in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum. She said hunger is very concerning and that water is scarce in the region. Just 2 of 21 wells still work in Adigrat, a city of more than 140,000, forcing many people to drink from the local river. With sanitation suffering, disease is spreading fast in the region. Vinola said, you go 10 kilometers from the city and it's a complete disaster with no food. Humanitarian workers struggle to gauge the extent of the need of the peoples of the region. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director in Ethiopia, said, "Not being able to travel off main highways, it always poses the question of what's happening with people still off limits." Before the conflict, Ethiopia's National Disaster Management Body classified some Tigray wardas, or administrative areas, as priority regions or priority one hotspots for food insecurity. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director, said, "If some already had high malnutrition numbers 2.5 months into the crisis, it's a safe assumption that thousands of children and mothers are in immediate need of food and aid." The Famine Early Warning System Network says parts of central and eastern Tigray region are likely in emergency phase 4, just a step below famine. John Shumlansky, the Catholic Relief Services representative in Ethiopia, said the next few months are critical. Shumlansky said his group so far has given up to 70,000 people in Tigray region a 3-month food supply. Asked whether combatants use hunger as a weapon in Ethiopia, one concern among aid workers, John Shumlansky dismissed it by Ethiopian Defense Forces and police. With others, he didn't know. He said, "I don't think they have food either, though."
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behruz Najafi. January 20th is expected to usher a new era in U.S. politics. This, of course, following 4 years of jingoism, blame games, and divisive policies practiced by the Trump administration. The Pentagon is so worried about insider attacks by service members that it had the guards tasked with securing the ceremony vetted. Now, what's made Washington, D.C. resemble a garrison? Is a large National Guard deployment supposed to protect Americans against their fellow countrymen? What's going on in the United States? Does the inauguration mark the end of Trumpism, or is the ideology there to stay? Stay with us for a debate on that.
The United States is bracing for the inauguration of Joe Biden as the country's 46th president on January 20th. Before and after winning the race, Biden repeatedly pledged to unify the country after 4 years of divisive politics of his predecessor, Donald Trump. He will certainly make that call again in his inaugural address just weeks after Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building in an unprecedented bid to overturn the presidential election outcome. The January 6 events are a stark reminder that the transfer of power in the U.S. will be a rough ride. They also indicate that the incoming president will inherit a deeply divided nation and a crisis-laden White House. Biden will be inaugurated despite a large segment of Americans still viewing Trump as a winner of the presidential race. Nearly 75 million Americans who voted for Trump still question the legitimacy of the results despite the Electoral College and the U.S. Congress confirming Biden's victory. These divisions have pushed the U.S. to the verge of becoming a police state, with thousands of National Guard troops and police deployed across Washington, D.C. The state capitals are also on high security alert amid FBI warnings of potential violence during the presidential inauguration. Ironically, a country long known for its voluntary securitization of democratic institutions of other nations is now struggling to protect itself from its very own citizens. However, tensions are not limited to the public alone. It appears that the intensifying partisan antagonism, as has been the case during Trump's 4 years, is going to remain an outstanding characteristic of American politics. From foreign policy to domestic issues, ranging from the economy, the new coronavirus pandemic, to the impeachment of the president himself, Democrat and Republican congressmen are highly at odds along different lines. Will the American society heal anytime soon? The election, marred by fraud claims, the recent breach of the Capitol, as well as anger over racial discrimination and police brutality, all reaffirm the U.S. is being torn apart. Biden has vowed to look beyond red and blue to discard harsh rhetoric that characterizes the current state of U.S. politics. Only time will tell if he can really find a solution for such a long-seated division.
Let's get started with the debate show. Joining me will be author and political commentator Ian Williams from New York and writer of Geopolitics and Economist, Economic Alliance, Charles Orter, also joining us from New York. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ian, the number of National Guard troops in D.C. exceeds the number of U.S. troops deployed to Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan combined. Is such a huge deployment supposed to protect Americans against Americans?
It's to protect the incoming president and the institutions against small bands of marauding Americans. It's not as unprecedented as everybody's seen. They've had large crowds like this before. In face with popular protest about unemployment, Eisenhower pulled in the troops. They broke up the homeless cities in Washington. So, a lot of people are raising their eyebrows as though this is completely unprecedented. What happened in the Capitol Hill was shocking, but it almost happened in state houses all over the country recently, and more to the point, historically it happened all the way through Reconstruction. Whenever there was a black majority elected, you found that white mobs disguised as militia turned up there, had a military coup, often linked to people concerned, and were given impunity by the federal law enforcement once the federal troops had been withdrawn after the Civil War. They were given impunity by the police and the FBI and the others, who basically let them get away with mass murder. So you can almost see it, if you saw the interviews with the people who took part in this, there's a serious sense of indignation and entitlement, but they're not supposed to stop us. The police aren't there to stop us. The police are to stop the other guys. The police are to beat up the black people. They're to beat up the leftists, but we're the ones on their side. They're supposed to be with us. And this, I can only call it a brown shirt mentality, because it is how Hitler's brown shirts thrive. Because they had impunity for committing political acts from the police and the state forces in Germany at the time. And that's the way these people behave. They are really shocked. And the question is whether you can go through. But, you look, there's an Air Force officer there who had a track record of making threats. He had handcuffs in his hand. He was in uniform, protectively in the Capitol. And he was released on bail in the run-up to the inauguration. So you can almost see that even under these changed circumstances, they have a sort of serious expectation of impunity that it won't apply to them. A lot of them were arrested and released on bail. That did not happen to the Black Lives people. They're arrested on suspicion, and they throw away the key more often than not. Whether they should or shouldn't, you can disapprove of burning places and attacking the police. But if one set of people can do it with impunity and the other can't, then it's a real symbol of what's happened. And this is 4 years after Obama was the president of the United States, and it just shows the measure to which Donald Trump has reversed history, attempted to reverse history. with some degree of success. But it's the poll figures suggest that he's on a loser in the long term. Most Americans polled last week thought that the police did behave far more leniently to the rioters on the Capitol Hill than they would have done to a black crowd doing the same thing. Which, you know, it's a measure of some degree of introspection on the part of the American public and electorate that they noticed it. On the other hand, significant proportion of Republicans denied it, and if anything, said that the police were hard on them and were far too lenient on the black demonstrators. And it's this bipolar detachment from reality which Biden has to deal with. These people aren't going to believe anything.
Okay.
The only thing he doesn't have to deal with is that Trump is not now. He's cancelled himself out as the putative leader of the opposition, which he was almost certainly going to be. It was a new post for America, because usually the failing candidate just disappears. He was going to stay there and vociferously guide in the opposition, which, of course, was one of the reasons why the Republican leadership threw him overboard. They didn't want him anymore. They got rid of him. He was no more use to them for winning elections.
Now, Charles, many experts believe that the United States is experiencing a deep-rooted political and social divide. What has led the country to such a polarized state?
Well, I think it's a good question. You've got to go back over a longer period of history. I think the first mistake that your analyst in the package made in assessing the current state of affairs is that it is not simply a Republican versus Democrat debate. There's a feeling in this country, I think justifiable, that both political parties have failed advocates on either conservative ideals or progressive ideals, and a large percentage of the population is anti-both party. So you're talking about independents, you're talking about Republicans, you're talking about Democrats, and most of the polls don't sample properly, but either by underweighting independents or by skewing to Democrats over Republicans, what public opinion may be. The second piece of the equation is, I would argue, that since about 2002, with the advent of broadband, internet, and technological advances, people who work in the private sector have seen their per-hour inflation-adjusted wages plummet. So there's a deep-seated dissatisfaction in this country with how the elites are managing things to the expense of the underclass, which is really 80-85% of all private sector workers. And that's really, I think, the most combustible thing, that if you believe as a passionate youth, age 25 or whatever, that you could never make a go of it in the system, you're drawn to the BLM rallies, the Antifa rallies, let's burn the system down, let's start from scratch. So it's a very vexing set of problems. At present, America remains the largest, most successful economy, the wealthiest collection of people on the planet, but we also have a towering debt and structural government deficits that have not, all the spending has not cured the underlying problems.
Okay. Now, Ian, there are a number of analysts who are concerned that this Trumpism is not going to go away. They argue it's there to stay. Do you share the same view?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Charles just said. The secret of Trump's success was the fact that a lot of people in this country felt totally neglected. The antipathy to Clinton was partly because she's the epitome of the Democrats who abandon all principles. They're militant middle. They're looking after the comfortably off, and she wouldn't go campaigning in the Rust Belt. It's significant that Bernie Sanders voters went for Trump because he represented the type of protest we're just talking about. And I'm not sure I've seen real signs yet that Biden has realized the depth of this problem. It's not just since 2002, by the way. It's since 1973. So, I think it is since the Reagan era, working class wages have declined in real terms at a time of unprecedented productivity, of unprecedented wealth. I always find it difficult to say creation in connection with these billionaires, but wealth appropriation by these people. The country is producing more and more money, and more of it is going into the hands of the few. Both sides see this. And the fact that the Democrats have let the... I mean, this is the real irony. It's Turkey's clamoring for Thanksgiving, because all of these people demonstrating there about plutocracy were demonstrating objectively in support of plutocracy. Trump did nothing at all to help ordinary people in this country. In fact, most of his measures were designed to thwart their efforts. But he presented himself as it, and this is where the image comes in. The image is very important. So Trumpism will continue. But, you know, to some extent, I think that Trump was a unique character who managed to pull all this together. Whether the Republicans can pull another one, I don't think Mike Pence, and certainly not the Liam Mitch McConnell, are have the charismatic populist sort of gung-ho of Trump. Because it's amazing. Trump is a political genius. I mean, there's no end about it. I don't think he sat there and thought his strategy out. He didn't sit in a cell writing Mein Kampf or anything like that. Just every time he opened his mouth, he had a straight into the ears of those disaffected people we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What he said was music to their ears, and it's like the famous journalist H.L. Mencken said that, you know, at some point the great mass of American idiots will discover that they've got their life's wish and they've elected one of them as president. And that's what it was. This man was ignorant, he was uncultured, he was rich, but he behaved like a nouveau riche, even though it was old money. It's one of the Republican playbook characteristics now. George W. Bush acted like a compound cowboy when he came from many generations born with silver spoons in their mouth in the Northeast. But he acted like a Texan, chewed tobacco. Even at Harvard, apparently, he chewed tobacco. Mm-hmm. It was a cultivated persona, and Trump didn't have to cultivate it. Trump was genuinely a Philistine. He didn't have to work on it. He's on the genetic Philistine. So he behaved like the people he was appealing to, and they appreciated it. He knew this. Mm-hmm. There was a resonance there, and I just hope it's gone away with what's happened. I hope he's blown it. But, you know, the man has got deep reserves, and it's not with admiration I say that I would not discount him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, Charles, there are more than 70 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump this time around. So, and that's the second highest total in American history. What's going to happen now? I mean, how would his supporters feel about this? How would they react?
Well, I think that to take issue with just one comment that my distinguished colleague made, I said that starting 2002, the pace at which the plight of the working person's after-tax real incomes declined accelerated rapidly. And that really it was a sudden shift downwards, and it's been low ever since. I think that the Trump supporters and Trump himself can point to a lot of accomplishments under the Trump presidency, domestically as concerned unemployment and wage increases and job creation, particularly for undereducated or uneducated people without a high school degree or maybe a few years of college. Across different minority groups among women, there was great strides made in the 4 years of really in the 3 years before the pandemic, and then internationally, if Barack Obama had achieved one of the Abrahamic Accords, just one, he would have gotten another Nobel Peace Prize. Well, we could talk about all other different international accomplishments. Trump did not start a single war. You can say that maybe by encouraging MBS. He's partially responsible for Yemen, what was happening in Yemen, but the United States did not get engaged in a war under his presidency.
Yeah, but he sold weapons to Saudis.
Strengthened the military, mm-hmm. but he didn't instigate the kind of conflicts that Barack Obama did.
Okay. And my question remained unanswered, Charles. Can you answer that? What are those 70 million plus Americans going to do when Trump is no more in office?
Well, they're going to look for a new candidate. I mean, I think the truth is that from 2008 forward, we've had the illusion of prosperity. You can go further back even to 2001 forward, because central banks have suppressed interest rates and pushed up asset values, and the rich are happy in that environment. Now, as we see debt loads surge across the planet, there's going to be a reckoning, a capital markets crisis, a stock markets crisis, and Joe Biden does not have the basic instincts to address that crisis properly, nor does his team. So there are going to be great challenges under this Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be tested around the world, particularly by the Chinese. And there are, as you correctly point out, 74 million people who think that perhaps the election result was stolen from them. So they're not going to unify behind Biden.
Okay, now, Ian, regarding issues...
Only half of them think the election was stolen. About half the people who voted accept half the people who voted Republican seem to accept the results. The other half are still disputing it. It's it's difficult, and we shouldn't merge the figures together. That's one of the problems, as you yourself before pointed out, that everything is lumped in a binary fashion here. You have to be either Democrat or Republican, when an awful lot of people can't tell the difference, especially when it comes down to individual candidates. And, you know, the loathing with which the Clintons were sort of treated and thought by many of so-called Democratic voters was considerable. I mean, a lot of those people voted for Trump, not because they liked Trump, but because they disliked Hillary and Bill Clinton so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's these issues which are... The type of polling that they do here on binary two-party system doesn't always calculate in the final mix, which is why everybody is chasing for the middle, because they assume if there are two blocks of what's called extremes. I don't think they're extremes. I don't think the extreme Democrats want something of soggy Dutch or soggy Swedes. They're not extremists at all. They don't go around shooting and lynching, and they don't go threatening people. They don't burn down the Capitol. Maybe they would have got further if they had done in the past, but they didn't. And they're extreme moderates, if anything. But it's very difficult to pass these numbers over that. But what we do know is, unless something changes, Biden is the person who, after all, destroyed bankruptcy protection for these people. He was the one who made it so they lost their homes. He framed the legislation as the Senator for Delaware and the insurance companies. So now it's up to him to redeem himself and show that he does have a plan that's going to protect the weaker people in America, the people who have been cheated for the last 20, 30 years or more. And I don't completely see signs. Some of his appointments are reasonable, but he's actually been very careful to cultivate the middle again. And the trouble is, as we all know, the old saying has it, if you stand in the middle of the road, you get hit by the traffic on both.